All right, Shabbat Shalom. Shalom. Peace. It's a wonderful blessing, isn't it? Simply awesome to be with us. It's great to have an us. Everything going on in our country, in the world, really, it's really kind of easy to get into a kind of a state of introspectiveness, I guess that's a word. You know, things are changing all around us, and it kind of gets you thinking about the things that are most important, right? You begin to take stock of the things that you treasure the most, and I just have to say that this is what I treasure the most, just all of you and our relationship with each other, and of course with Yehovah. And that's why we're here, right? To worship Yehovah and learn how we can further that relationship with Him. And hopefully, as we go through this series, we're going to find some more things that we can, that are barriers to that relationship. We're going to talk about that a little more next week become closer. Part 28 of this message, series, we left off with Exodus 17. And then, of course, we had a discussion week last week, and we went over Exodus 18, which was a good time to do that because there's no words of Yehovah in 18. So it gave us good fodder to talk about without encroaching on the purpose of this series. But I just want to bring that up because I want to say that I really enjoyed last week's discussion. It was very interactive. We just were able to bounce things off of each other and get into God's Word, and just really good stuff. Today we're going to look at Exodus 19. We find the Israelites having now made it all the way to the base of the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. And we begin in verse 1. And it says, "In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. For they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain." So they're 3 months into this thing. And at this point now, they're about to actually hear from God directly. They're going to hear the voice of God. Ahead of them lays a meeting with God that would forever change their own existence and really bring a new dynamic to the world as a whole. Because Yehovah was bringing Israel out of Egypt in order to meet with Him on holy ground, the mountain of God, for the purpose of doing what? Of establishing a new relationship, a covenant with the offspring of Jacob, of Israel. He had brought them out of Egypt, and now He wants to reveal the process of getting Egypt out of them. Actually, Yehovah had been kind of coordinating all of this for hundreds of years, step by step, with coming to this kind of pivotal event here. He had created a separate people through Jacob, and He allowed them to wander in a land that was not theirs, allowed them to become oppressed by another nation and enslaving them, and then He rescued them from that, right? And he let them witness all of these great miracles. I mean, I think about it, wouldn't that be cool to have seen all of this? I mean, really amazing. It's interesting enough just to read about it, but to experience it. And He demonstrated through all of the plagues of Egypt, which were disastrous, but didn't affect them. And it revealed to them, as we've discussed, that they are a set apart people. The Bible says that God made a distinction between them and the other nations. Yehovah personally led Israel by means of his visible presence, you know, through the desert, and he fed them, and he gave them water miraculously, and all these things. He fought for them. We talked about that, and defeated Amalek, and all of that. And so it's important to kind of reiterate those things a little bit to have perspective when we get to where we're at here at the base of this mountain, right at the mountain of God, the presence of God. And think about what they've experienced thus far in a very short period of time, 3 months. So with that all in mind, then there's a question. After all that God had done and showed them thus far, had Israel really changed much in this 3 months? I'd like your perspective on that later, but I'll weigh in first and just say kind of a cop-out, yes and no. Yes, in that now they were fully aware, weren't they, of the power of Yehovah, that it had no bounds, that Moses was the chosen one by God to lead them, and they probably now held a pretty healthy fear of Yehovah, of this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then also know in that when we look at what transpires, their faith was so very weak, and in some cases almost non-existent. They still didn't understand that Yehovah was not just to be the only God of Israel, but was the only God, period. They didn't quite understand yet the great sovereignty of this God as the creator of everyone and everything, right? So we're going to see clearly in this chapter that they did not grasp the holiness of El Shaddai, right? El Shaddai, the most high God, right? They didn't understand his sovereignty and his holiness. And so yet, Yehovah was still about to form an unprecedented relationship between a God, any God, as they viewed it, and men. An actual covenant relationship with God. See, the first covenant God constructed was really far more a promise than a covenant. But, I mean, it is a covenant in a sense. I mean, I'm referring to the Abrahamic covenant, right? It was a promise to Abraham that his descendants would do three things, that they would be many, and that he would provide them a place to live, a land, and that through those people all the nations of the world would be blessed. And Yehovah promised that to Abraham after he obeyed him. Okay? So from that point forward then, Abraham didn't have any obligations in this covenant. It was all on Yehovah, right? What the Lord would do going forward with that covenant, it had nothing to do with Abraham's future obedience. It was established because of his obedience, but it didn't have anything to do with his after obedience, because God had made a promise. But now, this covenant that's about to be made here is fundamentally different from anything else. Fundamentally. Because now, the people of Israel have a responsibility in this covenant. Abraham, that was a promise. It was a covenant, okay? So, you have to understand that covenants to these people were very normal. They were just an everyday thing, okay? However, covenants to them were either with two people, okay, agreeing, all right, or there were also covenants that were made with kings, the people and the king, okay? So, I'll be your king, and I'm going to covenant to do X, Y, and Z, And we have kind of that same, we have a constitution, right? Government's supposed to act in a certain way and the people are supposed to, right? Okay, that's kind of a covenant, right? Okay, so, but that is where you have a covenant of two equal people, and then there was these covenants of unequal. So like the king and the people, all right? And in that case, you know, the king could be over a few hundred people, over a village, or many villages. Sometimes if you was trying to create an empire, it might be several nations. So covenants to them were between either two men of equal power or kind of a king or ruler type of situation with the people. Now, we use the term covenant when speaking about the promise from God to Abraham, and we also talk about it in terms of the code, if you will, or the oracle given to Moses on Mount Sinai, and their covenants. They're covenant-like. But they don't precisely fit the standard covenant purposes of the ancient times, okay? As I've stated, the Abrahamic covenant was more of a promise, okay? It was one-sided. Covenants are not. And to them, covenants are between men. See, in both of those cases, it's men to men or a man with a deal. They were with men. So you need to understand what I mean by this being a really interesting. It's beyond the norm because there was never a covenant with a God. It didn't exist. It was a brand new phenomenon. And it was, and you know, it still is today, it is unique. There are no other religions or religion-based cultures that we find such a thing. And so as we go forward here, we're going to see that there wasn't many of these laws that Yehovah ordained through Moses in this covenant that were really new and strange to the ears of the Hebrews. It was more the fact that it was a covenant between men and God. You might not know that many of the laws and the commands that God would give them were familiar and had parallels in other Middle Eastern cultures. Now, not all of them. Of course, there are clearly some things within what we're going to be looking at as we go through this that are definitely unique to God, to God's law. He's fixing things that are wrong in the other cultures, for sure. But you'd be surprised to see how much of it you can go out and find parallels in. But again, what I'm trying to illustrate here is that it's the relationship of Hebrew people to a God, a covenant-like relationship, had no parallel in history before or even has been duplicated since. And so with that said, we see here in verse 2 that Israel indeed has arrived at the foot of the mountain. And immediately we see that Moses began to walk up there. And scholars will tell you, the ones that have studied kind of the ancient sages, I don't know if it's 100% true, but it's very much believed that he was just going right back to the place where he met God to begin with. That the burning bush is right there on this mountain. And so he goes up there, and straight away, Yehovah tells Moses, I've got a message for the people. You need to go down and tell them. Well, let's just read these words of Yehovah and consider these. Next verse is verse 3. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, Then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words, Moses, which you shall speak to the children of Israel. So first off, I want to highlight verse 4. You have seen what I did. What I did. Yehovah said, you're not here because of anything you did. You're here because I did it. I smote the Egyptians. I carried you to this spot. And now I bring you to myself because why? Because I choose to do it. Isn't that cool? We have a God that chooses us. And this is a huge point in and of itself, because when we come to the mountain of God, it's not because of anything that we did. That's how it was then, and nothing has changed. Not a thing has changed. Yehovah started by setting them straight. We need to have that straight too, or we're likely to get some sort of a fat head. Yehovah is saying, this is my doing. I'm setting you apart. Guys, you are lost in bondage. And without me, you had no hope, but I'm the one that bore you out. And we do well to remember that. Then the very next sentence, verse 5, has that little two-letter word in it. That little two-letter word that gives much of Christianity so much grief that they loathe. If, it says, if you will hear, accept, and follow, if you will shema, hear and do, the new covenant, this new covenant that I'm about to give you, then, only then, if, only then, you will be a treasure to me. You'll be my possession. We'll have relationship, right? If you follow this covenant, then I'm going to consider you priests and a kingdom and be sanctified, holy, and set apart. If. And notice I said new covenant. I even kind of, emphasized that a little bit. See, this covenant, what we generally term the law or the Mosaic covenant, was indeed a new covenant. It was new. The covenant that they were working on was actually a promise. And that's what Israel was operating under at this moment, was the promise to Abraham. They were there because of the promise to Abraham, wasn't it? Okay? That promised them that they would be their, that they would have their own land, they would grow in numbers, and that they would be a blessing, right? So God has to perform that. He's still doing it. Is the Abrahamic covenant done away? No, he's still doing it. All right? They're getting a new covenant, right? That is going forward. And it was not to abolish the old one, was it? What's it doing? It's expanding the old one. So I made the promise now. Okay, here it comes. It's expanding. It wasn't doing away with the older promise, was it? God didn't come and say, hey, I know I told you, you were going to have a new land and all of that, and then that promise. But you know what? Now I'm just going to give you my law instead. I'm going to replace that and I'm replacing it with this covenant of law. No, the covenant of law was there to do what? To make the promise happen, right? These two covenants were complementary. They were working hand in glove. It's one reason why I hate using the word new covenant to the covenant that is Yeshua HaMashiach. For in our Gentile mindset, we have this picture that once we have a new covenant, then the old one has to be done, obsolete, abolished, replaced. And that's not true in Hebraic thought. That idea would have been so counter to the Apostle Paul, he would have just shook his head and said, what? Totally contrary to Hebraic thought and biblical thought. Okay? It's just not true. Certainly as in regards to the covenant that is Christ. I mean, in some ways, some elements of the earlier covenants are transformed. They're expanded. They go from being shadows, from being a promise of what's to come, to coming into reality, and growing into a higher essence of what was previously pointed to. I want to use the example of the sacrificial system. They used animal blood to atone for sin in that whole system. And if you think about it, that actually started in the garden with Adam and Eve, didn't it? There had to be bloodshed, and then that was a covering that they sent out. Okay? And so that whole system then would be fully expanded in the blood of Yeshua, right? But because that's the real blood, of course, and we all know this, that was pointed to by the animal sacrifice. So that was the final sacrifice of the sacrificial system. Okay? But I want you to get this. I want you to hear this. Okay? Because it's important. The sacrificial system didn't end. It didn't even change. Blood of an innocent animal was and still is required to atone for sin. Every time, in faith, you go to the Father and you plead the blood of Yeshua for your sin, you are enacting the sacrificial system. It is still in place. See, I get this argument all the time. Scott, the law has to be done away because we're not sacrificing anymore. You can't sacrifice all of that. All of that's done away. Hogwash. It's not done away. It better not be done away, because the sacrificial system, as being fulfilled in Yeshua, is the only thing that keeps me alive. The only thing that gives me eternal life. If that sacrificial system is gone, I'm a goner, and so are all of you, and so are all of them. It is alive and it's well, and God never changes, and that's that. It is not gone. Don't tell me the law has gone away because we don't sacrifice anymore. Yeshua sacrifices every time I have to go to the Father and plead His blood. So what we come to realize is that in a sense, each of God's covenants, at the time they were given, and this is just a perception that you need to get, that when they were given, God sees the end from the beginning. They're fully developed. When He said to Abraham, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to give you a people, and everybody's going to be blessed because of you, it was done. Fully developed. When He gives this covenant He's about to give, and all of these things that He's giving to them, they're done. They're fully developed. They're good and they're right and they're perfect. You understand that? And they just have to then from there expand. In our humanly world, we buy computers, or we buy cars, or we buy whatever, and then what happens? Just nothing flat, in a year, 2 years, You got to have another computer. Why? Because it's obsolete. It's junk. Because as humans, I don't want to use the word evolving. We're learning. We're growing. Right? Okay. And so we throw that thing away and we get the next one. And so that's the mindset we have. Oh, that one's no good anymore. Throw it away. Right? God's not like that. That's human. God is not that way. God doesn't create covenants like that. He didn't create a primitive, low-tech covenant with Abraham and then upgrade it to, you know, covenant 2.0 for the children of Israel, and then upgrade it again to the ultra jazzy, you know, covenant with Yeshua, and we just throw away the old ones as we go along. No, it's not true. Each and every one of those covenants were created and remain perfect and intact for the purpose in which He intended for each one of them. Now, listen, I know, and this whole thing is not to be, I've got other teaching on this. And so I know all about Hebrews 8. And then he says a new covenant, he's made the first obsolete. And what has come, now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. I know what Paul was talking about, but I also know what Paul's perspective was as a Hebrew and how he was trying to get across what he was getting across. One thing you need to understand is obsolete in the Greek here, what they've translated to obsolete, is just aging. It means it was older. That's it. Paul is saying that the former covenant, and by the way, it was a good covenant, right? God didn't break it. God still intends for it to be there, okay? He just wants some people that will be a part of it. And so he said, oh, I'm going to write it on their hearts now, okay? But he didn't break it. The covenant has aged, and yeah, it grows old. And it's only fading because its purpose and design is filled up, because it's already been expanded upon, right? Paul was a Hebrew, and in Hebrew thinking, the one stands on top of the other, and it expands and fills full the former one that is aging, but it doesn't do away with it. The new one puts on greater light, greater strength in the purpose, and that's the only thing that causes it to fade. I think of it like light. I think it's a good analogy. It's the only one it's not the only one. It's one I came up with. Of like the first covenant, or the first revelation of the covenant. That's probably a really great way of looking at it. I just thought about that. You know, Abraham, he gave this thing to Abraham, and then this one, and then the next one. It's all one covenant, and it's just kind of, anyway, it's getting revealed a little bit at a time. Anyway, I thought of it like a campfire, right? You know, it's nighttime, and you build a campfire, and what's it doing? It's providing light, and it's providing warmth. And so now the second covenant comes along as the sun comes up. Did the sun put the campfire out? No. Does the campfire continue to give off light? Of course. Does it continue to give off warmth? Of course. As much as the sun? No, but it's still there. It's still valuable. It's still, you know, one did not replace the other. The light and the warmth is expanded. Now it's not just around the campfire. Now it's everywhere because the sun has come up. It's levels of light and warmth. One doesn't diminish the other one. Not every analogy is perfect. I get that. That's just what I thought up. But the point is that each covenant builds upon the next. And then as time goes on, aging, as Paul put it here, more of the terms of the covenant get closer to their complete fulfillment. That is, the older covenant, the more of those terms have been fulfilled and the fewer number of them that were that are left to be fulfilled. But it doesn't mean that it's gone. Fulfilled doesn't mean gone. If you have a glass or a cup, okay, and it's filled full, is that the time now you just get rid of it because it's filled full? That's what fulfilled means. Filled full. It doesn't mean done away. All right? In the Abrahamic covenant, Israel was promised a land of their own, and today they have it. Abraham's descendants have indeed blessed the Gentile world as well as the Hebrew world. Look at all of the things that have come out of Israel. Do that for yourself sometime. Look into that. It's amazing. In the medical field, every field there is. I mean, it's amazing. The blessings, beside the fact that Yeshua came from them, and that is what blessed. That's the grand fulfillment of it. But even in a physical sense, Israel has blessed the world with the Judeo-Christian morals and everything else. In the Mosaic covenant, the purpose of the sacrificial system, of course, has been brought to fruition in Yeshua's death. But the purpose of law in showing men God's principles and attributes and morals and what pleases Him, does that not go on into the millennium and past the millennium? Without it, how would we know what the definition of sin is? How would we even know what to repent of? Even the newest covenant, the newest revelation of the covenant, has items that have been checked off, hasn't it? The Son of David, the Messiah, Yeshua, has already come. He's already atoned for sin. So now does that mean that the new covenant is now obsolete? I hope not. I hope not. The Abrahamic covenant is the furthest along in the path of having its things fulfilled. Just like I was talking about, you know, all those promises we're really seeing them having been fulfilled. And that's just talking about the physical implications. Not even to mention the spiritual implications of all of these promises embedded within these covenants. So all three are needed. They are all still valid. And it's just that some are closer to having every element of their original intent and purpose being fulfilled. Does that make sense? I do want to maybe try one more analogy. When you build a house, what do? You prepare the ground. You build a slab or a basement, right? And then you put the framing up and the walls, and then you get the roof on, and you put up the drywall, blah, blah, blah. And you build a house. Let me ask you. If you build a slab, and it's in, and its purpose is established, is it time to take it out? Is it time to do away with it? If you build the house, and then you say, oh, that old thing, that's done away. We don't need that anymore. And you rip that out, what happens to the house? See, it's dumb. It's Greek linear philosophical thinking that is Satan derived. Hebrew thought. God doesn't think like that. He is a creator. Satan is a destructive force. God starts and he builds and he builds and he builds and he builds. He doesn't put any junk in there that needs to come out. Where am I? Let's go back. Let's go back to Exodus. This is the next verse, verse 7. So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. You know, go down there and say, will you obey me, and all that. And then all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And so then Moses went back up there and took the words of the people. But what we see here in verse 7, Moses was instructed to take this message of Yehovah to the people. And I want to try to think about this a little bit. You know, Moses didn't have like some big, I don't know, goat skin megaphone, right? This probably took a few days when you think about it. I mean, he probably came down the mountain, he assembled the leaders of each tribe, they had to go back, there's probably roughly 3 million people in this desert, right? So it probably took a little bit of time to do this, because when we read verse 7, where the elders were gathered to Moses, and then verse 8, where the people responded that they would do all that Yehovah instructed, some time had passed. You know, I don't know how long, but maybe a few days. All right. So this would have gone down through the chain. Yeah, we'll do it. Back up through the chain. Moses is reported back, and he says, "Okay, I'm gonna go back and tell him this." And as I was thinking about this, there's a pattern here. Yehovah's pattern. First, he makes us aware of his presence. Second, he asks the question, "Will you listen? Will you obey? Will you follow me?" And third, if we respond yes with actions, then he enters into this relationship. And that relationship is a relationship of growth and building, and he don't expect us to be perfect to come in there. Then he begins to work with us. And this pattern, it's there. Think about the garden. God walked with him in the cool of the day. He made himself known. Then he says, will you obey me? Eat of that tree, don't eat of this one. By their actions, they said no. Okay, out. No relationship. Right? Think about Abraham. God made himself known to him. Will you obey me? Kill your son. By action, answer was yes. I will obey you. Okay, let's have a relationship. I'm going to give you promises. I'm going to make a good nation out of you. Think about Noah. God made himself known. He said, will you obey me? Noah said, yes. He said, okay, build this huge boat in the middle of the desert. I mean, it wasn't a desert, but, you know, it wasn't by the sea. And by his actions, he said yes. And so now he has a covenant, right? There's a relationship. And the pattern doesn't end. I mean, he gets here at the base of Mount Sinai. It's the first thing he does. But before God gave Moses his will to deliver to Israel, he asked the people, will you obey me? And since they said yes, okay, now I'm going to lay out my will for you. Will you obey me? Yes. Kill your son. Will you obey me? Yes. Okay. Build a boat. Will you obey me? Yes. Don't eat into that tree. See what I'm saying? Will you obey me? Yes. Here's my will. Will you do it? Over and over. Over and over. And the Bible tells us that God is no respecter of persons. And if if it's true for them, if it's true for Abraham, if it's true for Moses, if it's true for Adam and Eve, if it's true for an entire nation, how stupid do we have to believe to think that it's not true for us? God makes himself known to us. And he asks, will you obey me? Yes. Here's my law. You want to be in relationship with me? Here it is. It's no different. The pattern is perfectly clear. Why anyone would think that the principle for entering into a relationship with Jehovah is any different today than it was then, it's wrong thinking. It's demonic thinking. And to listen to the church leaders out there today, that's exactly what they're trying to tell you, is that no, we're special. All of that is done. No, you don't need to do any of that. You don't need to respond to God. Just have this intellectual awakening that He is God. These guys knew it was God. They watched him through. That's why I talked about and summarized this 3 months. They had more of a objective calling than any other people. He demonstrated his godliness to them. And then he says, will you obey me? Okay. Here's something I want you to think about, because if indeed what is being promulgated out there was true, that means that God is able to make these covenants and then kind of change his mind and do away with that and hear something different kind of thing. If that is the character of Yehovah, if he would do such a thing, then he could also rescind and abolish the covenant that we're under right now. And if he can do that, then we're all toast, aren't we? We've talked about that over and over. And so I know I don't even have to read this, that Yeshua himself taught that no element, not even the slightest, had been removed from the Torah with his coming. And that those that taught those elements, that taught that they were removed, would be what in the kingdom? Least. But those that teach and demonstrate that they are eternal are greatest in the kingdom, right? So let's just follow Christ's directive and get back to God's instruction for life, right? All right, let's get back to where we were in Exodus. The last of verse 8 says that Moses went back up the mountain to tell the Lord what he'd already knew, that the people had said yes. Yeah, we'll do it. So he's going up to have this conversation. That's kind of a side note on the lighter side. I read a thing once about what that conversation would be like today, that Moses would go up and he would say, hey, God, I really need some perspective. You know, what's a million years like for you? And God said, about a minute. And Moses was like, wow, that's really cool. So what's like $1 million to you? It's all a penny. So Moses said, cool, can I have $1 million? And Yehovah said, sure, just a minute. Just a minute. It's cool. It's kind of a cute little joke, because it just illustrates that Yehovah's perspective is not ours, right? We do well to remember that. Okay, let's see what the conversation was actually about. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. So Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. Some interesting things here. After Moses went back to God with the people's response that they would listen and obey, Yehovah told Moses that he would come back in this thick cloud, and then when he spoke to Moses, the people would also hear his voice. So he's to go down, he's supposed to speak, and then God's going to respond, and all the people are going to hear his voice. Why? Why did he want that? Because he wanted the people to believe Moses. He was giving them authority, giving Moses authority. And because God knew these people well, and he knows us well, despite all that Yehovah had done through Moses, he knew that the people would be skeptical. That Moses couldn't come down and say, okay, you're to do this, 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 and this. And God wanted the people to know that it's not Moses giving this, that it's him giving this. Later on in the series, we're going to see they had problems with this in spite of all of this. But before he would give the teachings, he instructed Moses that the people were to be cleansed. They were to purify themselves, wash their clothes, all of this. And on the third day, after the purification process, then God would come. Okay. What you see, though, is even with this purification, they cannot come into God's dwelling place. The mountain, because God was there, was holy. And Yehovah instructed Moses that they were to build this border, this fence, if you would, as a demarcation between them and God's presence. And so we get this principle then that there is this barrier between God and man, between earth and heaven, between these two spheres, if you will. And we understand that where God dwells is so holy and so pure, it cannot be corrupted with the presence, with a corrupt man, right? There has to be absolute purity. And then notice that it didn't matter the outward cleansing of the Israelites, washing themselves and such and their garments. It wasn't enough to cross that fence, that barrier, to stand on holy ground. Because while the ritual washing they were instructed to perform, it was symbolic of internal spiritual cleansing, it was still just an external cleansing. This washing was not able to purify them the way that the blood of Yeshua purifies us. Because it takes that spiritual washing to accomplish that. They weren't allowed to cross over, or they'd die. And this, of course, was even applied, it says, to the animals. So they probably built a pretty cool wall, right? I mean, what did they build it out of? What was there? Stones, that's it. I've been there, that's all there is. It's stones, it just had to be stones. Some people believe that they've even found remnants of this wall because they think that, you know, the wall had to be pretty high because otherwise the goats and the sheep jump over it, right? Animals are valuable in that culture, so they probably built a pretty good wall. And some people think that they have found remnants of it. But again, God told Moses at the appropriate moment, he's going to sound this trumpet and call Moses. And then the people were to approach the mountain, but stay behind the fence. And he'd become visible in this cloud, this thick cloud. And I can just imagine the apprehension, right? I mean, there had to have been a lot of buildup to this, right? And you know, we don't have time. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to read it. You can read it on your own, but the bottom line is, you know, the cloud forms, and there's lightning, and there's thunder, and the mountain is shaking, and I mean, this is intense. And then this sound like a shofar thunders out off of this mountain to the point where it's reverberating off of all the rocks and the other mountains in this area. And this is quite the sight. It's, in fact, it says that it terrified them. This whole congregation of Israel is just terrified at this, at the display of this power. And so, according to what he said, you know, Moses came and he spoke to the Lord, and the Lord answered audibly, verbally, voiced out to the people. And what did he say? What God said was, Moses, come up, basically. So all of that, you know, was all about him just saying, Moses, you're my guy. Come up. So Moses went up to the top. This was a very brief encounter. he gets up there, and immediately the Lord said to Moses, go back down. Warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many perish. Also, let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves. Lest the Lord break out against them. But Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to the Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set the bounds around the mountain and consecrate it. But the Lord said to him, away, go, get down, and then come back up, you, and bring Aaron with you. And do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. And so Moses went back down. God immediately had to tell Moses, yes, we'll obey you. And then he comes up there, and God is like, oh, no, you got to go back down there. No, not working. I got a lot of people. I know what they're thinking. They're going to come. You got to go back down there and warn them. Right away. You know, God, nothing slips by him. He knew that there was a bunch of them with this inclination to disregard parts of God's instructions about the barrier, and they were planning on jumping the fence. And Moses says, oh no, God, they won't do that. We told them not to. God says, well, nah, go, right? They're going to cross it. Go tell them again, and by the way, bring Aaron back with you when you come. Which is something else that I'm going to talk about quickly. It's something embedded here in these words in verse 24. So we get this other principle, don't we, that will come into play in the tabernacle and later in the temple, that the only one that goes into the holy place was the high priest, Aaron. Now, Aaron wasn't the high priest yet, was he? The Levitical priesthood hadn't been established yet. We're still at the base. We haven't even got the Ten Commandments yet. But God knew who he was going to put there. So he says, Aaron, you come up. But not the rest of the priests. Right? No lesser priest was to do so. Same with the tabernacle and the temple. Only the high priest went into the Holy of Holies. You couldn't stand on holy ground. The other thing that's interesting, I'll try to hurry along here, is this idea of Moses. Moses was coming and going at will. Aaron needed to be invited that one time, but Moses was just coming and going. It's almost to me, that God was allowing Moses to act like the Father, representing the Father. Aaron, we know, was representing Yeshua as our high priest. And so, anyway, I just kind of throw that out there. But I want you to also notice this reference to priests. He says, don't let the other priests come up, just Aaron. What priests is he talking about? The Levitical priesthood hadn't started yet. Right? So, who are they? Well, when you study in, and I had to look into this, back in the Middle Eastern cultures back then, the firstborn were the ones that led the families in all religious rites and sacrifices and things like that. They had priestly duties in the family. The firstborn were called priests. Okay? Jethro was likely a firstborn, okay? And so he was a priest of in Midian, okay? And when God killed the firstborn in Egypt, he killed all their priests. And he left all of Egypt's priests. They were to be the priesthood. But they blew it. I mean, we'll get there. When we get to the golden calf and all of that. They blew it. They lost their their calling, so to speak, to be the priest. And so Yehovah pivoted in that sense. And so he knew then, and he knew this going in, that he would then establish a wholly separate priesthood that would function the way the firstborn used to, and that firstborn thing would end. Chapter 19 ends here with verse 25, and Moses trekking back down the mountain and once again telling the people, including the priests, stay off of God's mountain, right? Stay off. So Yehovah, with all that he had done and shown Israel up to this point, there's no question that he had made himself known to them. Through Moses, he asked them if they wanted to be in relationship. In our terms today, we would say, you know, they were called. And they said, yes. Yes, we'll obey you. But Moses, no more than delivering that information, had to go back down because some were already wanting to disobey. They were saying yes with this, but they weren't saying yes with this and this. Shema, you have to hear and do. Accepting the calling of God is not about some mental ascension of His godliness. It's about following Him, being a disciple, having Him be Lord and Master of your life. Was God pleased with their verbal acknowledgement of His existence? Or did He require more for them to actually Shema, hear and obey? The answer is obvious. And when they didn't, the relationship was not there. See, it's that pesky recurring if thing. But the neat thing is, guys, that He also knew their frame. He knew right from the start that they would blow it. In fact, He sent Moses down and He said, go down there and intervene before they do it. Why? Because he loved them. Like, I know you're going to do it. Go and warn them again. Right? And so what's He give us? He gave them the sacrificial system. Because He knew they would blow it. Here and there. And so that sacrificial system allowed people to offer a sacrifice and say yes again and endeavor to go. And every time that occurs, the relationship is restored. Okay? That's why it can't go away. It can't go away. It hasn't gone away. It's been filled full and it's been perfected. And as I said, we keep that sacrificial system every single time we acknowledge sin, we go to the Father and we plead the blood of Yeshua. Don't let anybody tell you the law's done away because we can't keep it. Because we can't do this, we're not doing the sacrifices anymore. It's not true. It's not true. In Greek thought, the old system has gone away, but in Hebrew thought, in biblical terms, it's still very much in force, and you are keeping it continually, walking in repentance with Yeshua. As long as you are a sinner, you better be keeping the sacrificial law. Right? Because it's the only way you stay in covenant with Yehovah. I actually have another important thing to bring out in this context, but I'm going to wait until next week. We're going to stop here because it leads up to it leads up into chapter 20, and of course this is where Yehovah is going to set the cornerstones, if you will, of His law with His own voice, these cornerstones. So we're going to end here and we'll circle up, and I'd love to hear what you guys pulled out of this chapter. That's what I got. So let's circle up and discuss. Sound good? All right.